you look at the aggregated inflation impact from back from 2020 to today, it's roughly around a 24% increase, right? That's what we're talking about.
My God.
And there's a and that's a significant volume impact on consumers' expenditure. And 100% agree with you. If you look at the impact of wage increases over that period of time, you're nowhere near that. So wages have not kept up with it, and the US consumers have become worse off. It is there's no question around this. I think in the last year or so, I think it's since the summer of last year, we are starting to see wages outstrip inflation. And so there is some relief coming into this equation. But I am extremely worried about how this continues.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Inflation's been called the invisible tax. Economist John Maynard Keynes wrote that through it, quote, governments can confiscate, secretly and unobserved, an important part of the wealth of their citizens in a process that engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction and does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose. Which is why it's very important to know what's happening with inflation and where it's headed. But should we rely on government's reported numbers, as distorted as they are by fudge factors like hedonics and substitution and possible manipulation for political optics? No, says today's guest, Oliver Rust, co-founder of Trueflation, a new blockchain-based real-time inflation calculation service that uses over 10 million data points to yield a more accurate measurement that represents what households actually experience. We'll find out what he thinks the true inflation rate is and where he sees it heading next. Oliver, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks all for having me on.
I appreciate that. And just so folks know, you were staying up late on the other side of the planet to have this conversation. I really appreciate you doing that. Oliver, I've been looking forward to having you on for a good while. I've mentioned Trueflation a number of times on this program, as do people in the comments section pretty frequently. I think it was first put on my radar by Danielle DiMartino Booth, who's a big fan of your work. Got a number of questions here for you. Real quick before we dive in, I just want to let folks know this video is releasing on a Thursday. Folks, if you are interested in attending the Thoughtful Money online conference on Saturday, March 16th, just a reminder that the early bird price discount, that's the lowest price we're offering, expires at midnight on Friday. So I just want to make sure folks are real clear on that. If you want to lock in that discount, maybe just pause this video, go register now to make sure you get that lowest price. I want you to get that lowest price. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference. And a reminder that if you're a premium subscriber to our Substack, you get an additional $50 off of the conference with the savings code that's been emailed to all of the premium subscribers there. If you're not already a premium subscriber, you can scramble and sign up for that. Over at our Substack. I'll put up the link to it here, adamtaggart.substack.com. And I don't mind if you game the system. It only costs 15 bucks a month. You can sign up just for a month, pay the $15, save the larger $50, pocket the 35. I'm happy if you do that. I want you to get the lowest price. All right, Oliver, lots of questions here for you, all zeroed in on inflation. Before we start though, if I can just ask you a more general question, what's your current assessment of the global economy?
Yeah, look, I think the US obviously unexpectedly posted some really strong economic growth in quarter four. I think Europe has struggled a bit and is starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel to a certain degree. And I think, you know, you got situations in Asia Pacific that aren't as rosy, and it's predominantly driven by the Chinese economy and the Japanese economy. So the bright light, the bright star, so to speak, that's shining from an economic standpoint is definitely the U.S.
All right, definitely the U.S. Now, you know, some folks are wondering if the economy is chugging along so strongly in the U.S. And we're seeing things like wage growth that continue to contribute to inflation, and the Fed is now talking about rate cuts this year. You know, could we see some sort of resurgence of inflation here in the U.S. as a result of all that? We'll get to that in just a minute. Before we do, though, let's just explain for folks, let folks understand why you founded Trueflation in the first place. As I said in the intro, I believe that you believe it is a more accurate measurement of inflation. What prompted you to say, hey, the world needs a better measurement?
Yeah, so I think, we were looking at an inflation measurement as a whole, and we were looking through trying to create inflationary protected products. So if people were going to create inflationary protected products, what sort of inflationary measurement was out there? And our viewpoint is that our objective is to launch a measurement tool that is the most comprehensive inflationary measurement tool out there. We're not here to replace or find an alternative measurement for inflation as for the BLS or for that matter, the PCE price index or other forms of prices inflation out there, like the producer's price index and so forth. But our objective is to provide the most comprehensive inflation measurement. And in part, we believe that the systems that are being used today to report inflation have been set up a long time ago. In fact, the CPI measure was set up pre-First World War, and it hasn't really evolved in the way it's done today. And so for that purpose, whether it's the number of items it's tracking, it tracks about 80,000 items, the method it uses a price check, and it uses a survey-based approach, and they all got inherent issues. And our viewpoint is we wanted to create a more updated measurement. So we want to make sure it's updated daily rather than monthly. We wanted to have a much more volumetric data set. So you were talking about in the intro about having more than 10 million items. We're now up to about more than 14 million items that we track on a daily basis. And we also don't want to rely on one data source. So we rely on a minimum of three data sources before we release, an index out there. And today we're operating with more than 40 different data partners to be able to produce this measurement tool for the market.
All right, great. So when you say at least three data sources, if you're saying someone's buying a box of Cheerios, you get three different prices from three different sources for a box of Cheerios and I guess average it.
Yeah, so especially in the food category in particular, we use a data aggregator, which is Nielsen. We have another data aggregator called Deka, which looks after loyalty card data. We also have data directly from retailers like Amazon, Walmart, and so forth. So, if you're looking at that volume of data that we're dealing with, we have multiple different price points, as you say, for a box of Cheerios, right? And that gives us a pretty good understanding of how price is moving, and not only how price is moving, it's also how factors like discounting or promotions are affecting consumer switching behavior. Because consumers, we've noticed very clearly, consumers have substituted products of higher price points into lower price points products. And whether they're forgiven on the volume that they're purchasing, or they're just substituting it for a lower price point product, both of those situations are happening. And that's causing a different variation. So we need to make sure that we track multiple different price points to be able to have the most accurate measurement in the marketplace.
Okay, interesting. And just trying to understand how your service differs from the official government data, like the BLS. So is yours, and I don't mean this in any negative way, but is it simply a brute force approach that says we're just looking at what people are paying for all these different products using all these different sources, and that's just the number versus the government numbers? Like I said, they have things like hedonics that try to say, well, because a TV got cheaper, it's actually a better value, and we're going to massage the numbers this way to compensate for it. And what they do is substitution. There's sort of estimations that go on in there that aren't necessarily true compared to what people are paying at the counter. Is yours much more just a reflection of like, hey, this is just what we're seeing people pay across this much bigger universe?
Yeah, that's correct, right? We want to reflect how what consumers are experiencing from their price points and how it's affecting themselves across a multitude of categories. So therefore, given the volume of data that we deal with, we don't need to add additional calculations in the system, like a substitution calculation or a hedonics calculation for quality adjustments. We don't need to have that factor because we're seeing how consumers are spending on individual products because of the volume of data that we're dealing with. So, you know, if you take, for example, the BLS, they have a 80,000 price point they check out. They have a 6,000 survey for household rent information. And, you know, all that gives us that 80,000 price point. How much that 80,000 price point, 80,000 items that they're checking are in food, are in apparel, are in electronics. You know, we're not 100% sure how many price points they're checking in each of those scenarios, but you get an idea, let's say in food, even if it is 50,000 items, we're dealing in food alone, we're dealing with 8 million items of price point. So that volume allows us to create a much more comprehensive measurement of how consumers are adapting to the price changes in the marketplace.
All right. So how has your calculated number compared to CPI? Have they been largely in agreement? Have they been wildly different? Do they align at certain times and diverge at others?
Yeah, interesting question. Yeah, so look, let me say that first of all, our objective at Trueflation is not to not to replace the BLS, right? Our objective is to provide an alternative view of how inflation is moving in the marketplace. And that alternative view is, as we discussed, is a combination of looking at these 14 million different data points, 40 different data sources, and being updated daily. Now, in turn, a lot of our customers are saying, okay, well, how do I use this? One of the applications is, how do I use this to forecast what the BLS is doing? And in that, we are seeing our trend lines. You compare directly with our late data with the BLS. We're seeing, you know, that we have a different numbers. In the earlier part of the year, earlier part of the inflationary rise back in 2020, we were probably ahead of the curve. In other words, we were reporting a higher number than the BLS, and now we're reporting a lower number than the BLS. And I think if you look at how do we compare then the individual categories to the BLS, it's in part because the BLS is lagging the Trueflation data in certain categories to quite an extent. So in the smaller lagged categories like food and apparel, where the frequency of purchases is a lot higher, we tend to have, or the BLS is tend to having a lower lag compared to where Trueflation is. And if it's in the longer purchase intervals, let's say like housing, which is the most extreme, we have a 7-month lag. So we tend to look at it saying, well, the data that Trueflation is reporting is potentially a leading indicator of where the BLS goes. And what we tend to do is, for those customers who want to compare exactly how our data is translating back into the BLS, we then take all our data sets and we align it back into the BLS category defined, well, the BLS defined categories, and apply their weighting onto our data that is categorized according to the BLS weight, BLS categories, and we get a pretty damn good correlation with what the BLS is. In fact, you'll probably seen Danielle Martini Booth. She had a correlation of 0.97%. So it's pretty much spot on if we start comparing the two data sets. Okay. But that's only after we have merged our data back into the BLS data and their weighting factors. But if you look at a straight comparison of our data versus theirs, yes, we are generally higher than they were, and now we're becoming lower than they are.
Okay. And it sounds like that difference that you see is maybe more a time shift, where you're saying that they have more lagging data in there. So, you know, when you guys diverge, they generally catch up to you over time.
That's correct. We tend to see in catching up, or when it stabilizes, I'd say more of an equilibrium coming into play. But yes, there is a delay in the data sets that they have. And that's in particular being driven by the housing category. That's the one category that causes a lot of discrepancies. And that's in part because the BLS decides to take a rented data survey, household consumer survey, to determine what people are paying for their rent. And then apply that same survey results onto the people that own their property. And I think we look at that owned part considerably different, where we look at property values, we look at mortgages, outstanding mortgages, we look at the interest rates people are paying on those mortgages, and that changes literally how much people need to spend. And I think that's it's a pretty different way of looking at this, because not everyone owns their mortgage. Not everyone is paying a 5% mortgage. Some people are paying 2% interest on their mortgage. Some people, you know, don't have a mortgage left on their properties. And you can't attribute that same phenomenon to everybody.
Yeah. A couple questions that I should have asked earlier. In your 14 million items, factors that you're gathering data on, I imagine, you know, good information on goods, probably pretty easy to get a hold of. I assume you also are measuring services as well, price of services?
That's correct.
Okay. In at least the government data here, and housing's kind of a big part of this, but it's services where the inflation still seems to be quote unquote sticky. Are you guys seeing the same thing? Or as you said, your true inflation rate is lower. Maybe services inflation actually is lower, it's just because the BLS is looking at lagging indicators. It hasn't caught up yet.
No, but it is right. Yes, our number is lower, but the cause of the stickiness of inflation is the services element. That is in partly, as you pointed out earlier, is driven by the tight labor market. And I'm, you know, whether that's wage inflation, whether that's unemployment rate, I'm of the opinion that the reason why the unemployment rate is so low is more driven by people needing to find two jobs rather than one. I think that combined with wages increasing in part because unionized labor is renegotiating their contracts is fueling an increase in those numbers. And I think the services element, in particular, if you look at healthcare, you look at other services that are revolved around household care, you look at household securities, you look at operational aspects. You look at food services, these elements are seeing a significant increase. And even, you know, yesterday you saw Domino's Pizza, was it yesterday, the day before, Domino's Pizza is announcing they're increasing their prices at the stores as well. And you know, we're going to see more and more of these activities coming out because the cost of labor is increasing.
Okay. So I guess first off, where are we on inflation? What is Trueflation's latest reading?
So Trueflation has seen, right as of today, it is on the 28th of Feb, it is at 1.87%. It is beneath that 2% target. We have seen inflation numbers drop in the month of January and quite considerably due to the post-festive blues, so to speak, of November and December and the holiday season, where retailers, in particular retailers, have been looking to reduce the inventory levels, so the increased number of promotional activities, discounting, and so forth has been very prevalent. That's also followed through in the retail sales numbers that were released in January by the Census Department. And so we're seeing those trends coming through in our data, but now we're starting to see prices creep up again because those discounting elements are coming out and prices are increasing again. So, and that's certainly what we had forecasted and what we're expecting given historical trends and historical behaviors and in the marketplace that we're living in. So, and the conditions that we're in other words, high labor costs driving services up and the price of goods and retailers as they reduce their inventory levels and they get rid of the old stock and they put in the new stock, and especially in apparel, but also in food and other categories, that number is going to be slowly coming up. And that's what we're seeing.
Okay. Maybe you've already just answered this, but let me see if I can jump to the punchline here on inflation, which is 1.87, I think is what you said. So that's below the Fed's objective. So if we were using Trueflation as the meter, you know, the Fed could say, hey, mission accomplished, right? we're done. and you know, there are While there are a lot of people warning that inflation might prove stickier to tame, and again, if the Fed pivots too soon, and inflation isn't fully out of the system, you know, and there's all this deficit spending going on, and there are these continued wage renegotiations by the unions and whatnot, you know, there are people out there saying, hey, maybe the inflation fight's not over and we got to be really vigilant. There are other people who come on this channel and say, look, we still haven't felt the full force of all the lag effects from all the rate hikes that have gone on and the quantitative tightening. And those are going to hit at some point in time. And, you know, we've got this massive debt overhang and all the corporate, you know, companies are going to be hitting the maturity walls really kind of starting now. And so some people are saying, hey, look, you know, don't worry about inflation. Deflation is the bigger problem going forward. And looking at a one handle on inflation, you know, somebody might say, yeah, it's getting pretty low and it wouldn't take very much to tip that, you know, into deflation if there was a, you know, other recessionary forces hitting. So the big question I'm leading up to here is what do you think at Trueflation we should be more worried about going forward? Sticky inflation or actually the economy slowing too much?
So, let me start off by saying, I think the economy has grown faster than anyone expected in quarter four, right? It came in, everyone's expecting the 2%, it came in at 3%, there's some revisions that are going to come through with that number, but it is a lot stronger than we anticipated. You look at the retail sales numbers for January, it's a lot lower than people expected.
Yeah, they were a big disappointment.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was 0.8% down on the previous month. And the market was like only expecting it to be like 0.2% down. And I think, you know, a lot of this is to do with the historical trends behaviors that we've seen in the January sales. The January blues have always been pretty significant post the holiday season. Now, I think we are of the belief that the economy is strong at the moment, a lot stronger than we all have thought at. Is it going to decline further as a result of the interest rates? I don't know. I'll take that one as time goes by. But we're of the opinion that the inflation is not over yet. We think that inflation will remain sticky. And in fact, there is a worrying concern if I look at our data and try and project it forward, is I think the Fed is in a very tough spot right now. In the sense that I think they have come out and clearly said, okay, we've hit the terminal rate. We're now going to look at coming down. When do we start the cuts? And everyone's questioning, when is the next rate cut? Is it going to be in the March meeting? Is it going to be in May? Is it going to be in June? When is the next cuts? And I think our concern with that is, well, the economy is growing strong. So the Fed's sort of in a situation where it's saying we can cut it when we feel we're ready to cut it to boost economic development. And given the economic strength of the U.S. economy at the moment, they're in that situation that they probably want to be in, which says we can cut it when we are ready to cut it and when we need to cut it. I think that the flip side of this is what's concerning us, is that if you tend to cut the interest rates too fast, so do they do 50 basis points? Do they do 75 basis points? Or are they going to stick to 25 basis points? It could have a reverse effect on the increase in pricing. We're already starting to see prices creep up again. And if you reduce that, especially on the net effect that it has on housing with mortgage rates coming down and then repurchasing as the supply in the housing market remains tight, that will fuel then prices to increase again. And given the fact that, you know, in the BLS numbers, the housing or shelter accounts for nearly 40% of the total expenditure, it is quite a significant concern if that drops too fast, because then the 30-year fix or 15-year fix is going to come down considerably. And so that is a worry for us. It's like, and if you're in the Fed's point of view, if you're in the Fed's position there, they can't increase interest rates at the moment, or even if they had to, and if they did, I don't know how they do it, right? So they're in a position, they're quite in a quandary at the moment, because we're of the opinion that inflation is going to be increasing over time before it starts to really have a systemic effect on this. And the other factor to consider here is also, you know, the impact of onshoring, right? You know, looking at the energy, the innovation rates innovative green energy resources being invested in onshore. import tariffs causing people to develop more onshore in the US, which is increasing cost bases. And that naturally is going to, over a period of time, is going to have an impact on you know, prices that we as consumers pay for. And that's the bigger concern that's sitting on a systemic level for the long-term fight on inflation. So we don't believe inflation is over. And we think it's going to remain sticky before it really starts to come down.
Okay. And just on that last point there, because of reshoring, it's basically just a secular increase in the labor input costs to more goods, right? We benefited from cheap foreign labor. We're now taking some material percentage of that back home where you have to pay more in salaries and benefits and all that type of stuff. So just stuff's going to get more expensive going forward just because of that alone.
Yeah, 100%, right? And you think of the impact that China had on deflation or in the world that we lived in, you know, last 20 years. They've had a huge impact on deflationary prices. And I think, you know, the state of the U.S., the state of the China economy, the relations between the U.S. and China and the import duties that are existing and onshoring requirements, it's having a reverse effect of that.
Okay. So there's a lot of people watching who are saying, dang, you know, I was hoping, the beatings were going to let up a little bit, but you're basically saying, no, not quite. They're going to continue for some period of time, you know, maybe not at 9%, you know, like we saw a year and a half ago, but you know, we're not entering into a comfort zone around inflation. Okay, so let me just ask you this: how historically important in the inflation story was the post-pandemic response era? You know, where we had massive cost push inflation, right, by supply chains breaking all over the world. And we had, you know, massive stimulus stimulating demand. How, you know, like on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how impactful was that to the inflation that we experienced? And going forward, you know, are there, how long will we continue to experience the shockwaves from that?
Yeah, look, I think it's pretty unprecedented what we've gone through in the last 4 years, right? And I think if you look at just inflation alone, you know, we saw, you know, 2020, 2021, early 2022, we saw very much it being a supply-driven inflationary market. As you said, supply constraints, whether in the Ukraine war didn't help that either. And so a lot of supply constraints fueled the rise of inflation. Then the sort of revenge spending came in with you know, influx of expenditure for consumers. And I don't think that's...
Sorry to interrupt, but that was fueled by trillions in, you know, direct relief.
100%. And now that's sort of being normalized a bit now with wage inflation increasing, right? So wages are going up. The worry I have is that revenge spending that's fueled by the release that you mentioned, you know, when does that start to impact, if any, on delinquency rates? And so if you look at, you know, credit card delinquency rates, they're slowly creeping up again. They're above the averages and they're below where we were in the noughties, in the 2000s. But they are significantly higher than they have been throughout the whole tens. And I think that's starting to be something that one needs to keep an eye out and see how that progresses over time, because, you know, the interest rates or the APRs that people are paying on those credit card loans, which are have now exceeded over $1 trillion, should be of a concern, especially the delinquency rates increasing.
All right. Well, let me add on to that then. So you talked about revenge spending, right? Which was, hey, I've been cooped up and I've still got some money in my pocket from the stimulus. I'm going to go out and you know, have a good time. Now there's this, have you heard of this term doom spending? Which is, you know, people are, because of the increase in cost of living, and for most people, wages have not caught up with the inflation rate that we've seen, right? I pulled the stat on this. It's 64% or 68% of Americans, I can't remember exactly which, are saying that, hey, my wages have not kept up with the cost of inflation. And so people are beginning to feel, an increasing number of people are beginning to feel a lot of financial stress and beginning to feel like, you know, maybe they're hanging on by their fingernails and about to let go. And so there's this term doom spending where they're like, well, if the future's not going to be fun, I may as well treat myself to something today, right? Before I have to go into that bleaker future. So if you think that inflation is not fully tamed and is going to be sticky for a while, and have some secular winds behind it, like the higher, you know, labor from reshoring, like you talked about, how concerned are you that more and more, a greater percentage of the populace is not going to be able to keep up and is going to be increasingly falling into more dire economic times? You talked about delinquency rates going up. You kind of referenced it in the context of revenge spending, but you add doom spending into that where it's kind of like the last hurrah. You got to imagine what follows the last hurrah is increased delinquencies.
Yeah, so if you look at the aggregated inflation impact from 2020 to today, it's roughly around a 24% increase, right? That's what we're talking about. And that's a significant volume impact on consumers' expenditure. And 100% agree with you. If you look at the impact of wage increases over that period of time, you're nowhere near that. So wages have not kept up with it. And the U.S. consumers have become worse off. There's no question around this. I think in the last year or so, I think it's since the summer of last year, we are starting to see wages outstrip inflation. And so there is some relief coming into this equation. But I am extremely worried about how this continues on with about the doomsday spending and how consumers are looking for some sort of gratification expenditure amongst all the depressing news. But on the flip side of it, though, is the stock markets are pretty active and they're doing very well. Bitcoin, if you look in the crypto world, the Bitcoin is now nearly up an all-time high. S&Ps again growing as it was versus a year ago. Started the year well. And they have mixed reactions. But overall, I am concerned about how this affects the consumers with the increased inflation. And much as inflation is under control, yes, we're saying it's a 2%, whether it's a 3%, whether it's 2%, I'm less concerned about what the physical number is. It is still on top of a very high number that was around 9% last year. So if we think that in number, the prices are coming down, they're not, right? It's still an increase happening every year. We are not seeing inflation. We're not seeing wages recovering that increase in prices that the consumers have experienced. And hence why one of the things that we're looking at very closely is things like delinquency rates. And the delinquency rates in credit cards are up now to 3.2%. It has been a constant increase all the way since, the middle of 2021. The delinquency rates have been increasing quarter on quarter on quarter. And that is a concern for us.
Okay, so a couple of things. It worries me that you're worried only because this is something I worry an awful lot about. And I talk about a lot on this channel, which is the plight of the average person, certainly the working and middle class. So you mentioned there, hey, the stock market's up though, and so is Bitcoin. True. And that does have some wealth effect that may help the situation a little bit. But as I mentioned an awful lot, financial assets are not evenly distributed across society. They are highly concentrated in the top 10% of households. So the stock market going up in some ways kind of makes the situation worse because it makes the average person just say, well, I'm just getting screwed even more, right? The rich people are getting rescued because they own those assets and I'm just stuck with the higher cost of living and wages that aren't keeping up. And, I'm just getting the shaft here, right? And I don't know about you, but I don't know too many average people who, if I'd gone to at January 1st, 2020 and said, hey, your cost of living is going to go up by 24% in the next 4 years. I don't know many that would have said, oh, that's fine. I think most would have said, oh, that'd be game over. I'm living paycheck to paycheck as it is, right? So that's a massive injury that the household balance sheet has taken, or the household income statement has taken. And honestly, I don't know how many of these people are going to make it long term on this, right? Because we had all these things that were keeping them afloat, the stimulus, the forbearances on many different things that are now all getting pulled apart. And to your part, if inflation actually keeps grinding higher from here, albeit at a slower rate, it still doesn't really, it's not riding these people's rescue. So where I'm going with all this is, in the States, we have an election coming up in November. Given where you see inflation, how, we all remember back to, the Clinton campaign, it's the economy, stupid. Right now, immigration is a big topic. I think it's currently the topic in the number one slot in the polls. But I wonder if that's not going to get supplanted by the economy as we get closer to the election, because generally people tend to vote by how their wallet's feeling when they actually enter the election booth. How big of a factor do you think this pinch in cost of living is going to play in November?
I think it's going to be a significant factor, right? I think if you look at, you're 100% right. All the subsidies that the government has been spending on will slowly be reduced over time. So that subsidies is going to come off. I think you got additional impacts that, the student loans, which I think are over $1 trillion, that needs to get repaid and repayment cycles on that. And that's going to put additional pinch on the consumers, let alone the consequential impacts of inflation. And the fact that wages haven't kept up with that. And that's, when I look at the marketplace and I look at the unemployment rates, I'm of the belief that, as much as I see, Levi's and other companies announcing that they're going to reduce their headcounts, I think those that are reducing those headcounts are, as you say, are more of the top end of the marketplace. Rather than the working class that's driving this economy, that has driven this economy over the decades in the history. And so, my concern is here is I think people are taking double jobs just to pay off their bills. And this is going to be an increasing impact on the topic for the election. I think the Biden administration is going to continue on saying, oh, we've grown economic growth. The stock market's up, it's all gangbusters. And of course, the Republicans are going to come into play and say, look, there's a lot more factors at play here that's making it tougher for you. And we need to rebuild the US economy again. So, I think it's going to be a big factor as it comes to closer and closer to November. But, I think I'm more worried about what happens between now and then, right? And seeing how do we help the consumers deal with these increase in pricings and the consequential impacts it has.
Okay. All right. I want to just get your thoughts on this. I'm not saying this is going to happen. I will say there's possibility of this happening, but I'm not saying it's going to happen. But should, we've seen layoffs happen all through 2023 at almost twice the rate in 2022. We've seen layoffs really pick up here at the beginning of 2024, and I mentioned this corporate debt maturity wall that companies are finally hitting, right, where their debt has to get refinanced, and it's generally getting refinanced at a rate that's like 2x with of the debt they've currently had on their books, right? So if they're not, an AI-driven wonder company, most companies are having to go into cost-cutting mode, right? So let's say that layoffs continue from here, right? And let's say they actually like start really jumping up, right? If we start having sort of recession entry level job losses, again, not predicting they're going to happen, but just if we did, what impact, if any, would that have to your inflation outlook?
Considerably, right? I think it would have a huge impact on wages overall. It would have a huge impact on abilities for people to repay their loans from an individual perspective. Let alone from a corporate and from a government perspective, so net net it would have a significant impact, right? And if you look at trajectories in the past, if unemployment for inflation to be structurally under control, unemployment needs to raise, and it hasn't risen yet. So the inroads that the monetary policy has had an impact on I think has probably gone as far as it can do, maybe a bit further, but the structure, underlying structural impact needs to be addressed. And I think if the unemployment were to increase, I think that'd have a massive impact, consequential impact on inflation.
Okay. Would you expect to see inflation perhaps go negative, just given that we're already below the 2% bound right now, were that to happen? Or do you think for structural reasons, it would still stay positive?
Yeah, I think in a direct short term, I think we'll see. We're of the belief that inflation is going to stay positive. I think if you look at more of the mid to long term, with the impact of AI and the automation elements that's coming to play, I think then you probably might see it getting very close to 0% in our numbers. But a lot of that has to do with also inventory levels and promotions and discounts and pricing levels and a whole bunch of factors that come into play. But I also am worried about the geopolitical risks, which mean that prices probably won't come down as fast as we'd like, right? Especially given the current conflicts in the Middle East, around the Red Sea, with Israel, and you know, how does that impact on the prices of oil, right? And oil prices have been starting to go up a bit again. You know, every increase of oil prices, 50% of that is reflected on the increase of oil, of petrol or gas at the gas tanks, right? So there is direct correlations, and it's not a lag effect. It's pretty rapid impact on the prices of petrol, so, or gas. So net, I short term, I'm of the belief that we're not going to get into a deflationary environment, but I think medium to long term, there is a possibility. But the geopolitical aspect of it also needs to come under control.
Got it. Yep. What I'm getting from you is right now, if there's something that keeps you up at night, it's higher inflation, not lower inflation, but that could change for many of the reasons we're talking about. All right. I'm getting up to a big question, but real quick before I get there, I'm just curious if you have anything to say on housing. So I know you said earlier that it sounds like your measurement of home price or housing's contribution to the trueflation number is weaker than what the BLS is currently showing. I guess the question I want to ask you is there hope on the horizon for aspiring home buyers or not? And one of the questions that I don't necessarily expect to have the answer to, but you know, we've had this tremendous increase in the cost of home ownership, meaning it's a lot more expensive to finance a home now, right? Because mortgage rates have gone up so much. But also all the associated costs with home ownership have gone up. Maintenance is a lot more expensive now. You know, contractors are a lot more expensive. Input costs are a lot more expensive. But a lot of people have been scratching their heads saying, wow, the cost of a house has gone up, but average prices haven't gone down in the country. Yes, there are some markets that have started to cool off and whatnot, but we haven't seen, you know, normally there's a seesaw relationship between cost of ownership and prices. We've seen cost of ownership go up, but we haven't seen prices adjust for that. So are you seeing something different in your tools or no?
No, I think the biggest concern we've got on the housing market, and I'm generally talking about the housing market, not necessarily our metric, but we're seeing it through the metrics that we're reporting, is the supply, right? And if you look at, you know, new supply coming onto the market versus existing supply that's in the market, the number of new supply coming to the market of new properties is not significant. It is increasing. There is more supply coming on, but it's not at a significant volume that's going to bring pricing down. I think the second element is on an existing supply in the marketplace. People are not moving, right? Because they don't want to buy. And there hasn't been this normally, rephrase this, normally in the past, we have seen people move from A to B from work purposes, for educational purposes, whatever. And people have switched out their current mortgage and the current rent, they sold it and purchased a new property. And people don't want to do that, exactly as you mentioned, because, you know, a higher cost, not only is the cost of the property more expensive, but for the same price I'm buying today, I'm basically getting one less room. One less room is equivalent to what you're getting today. And, you know, if you look at that and you say, okay, well, I've got to pay a higher property tax, I've got a high maintenance cost, and there's no availability in there, why should I move? And so the movement of labor, the lack of movement of labor, the lack of supply in the marketplace, I think we will start to see some prices hold relatively stable, but I think it's going to go up again. And that's the worry I have. I mentioned right earlier, as soon as the interest rates come down, therefore the mortgage rates are going to come down. People might shift then, and that the mortgage prices are more, the cost of new housing is going to go up again. And that's the biggest concern that we've got.
All right. So you're maybe making current homeowners feel better, but dashing the hopes of aspiring buyers. I'll point out the irony in this world where, for whatever reason, cost of ownership goes up, price doesn't come down like it should. Cost of ownership goes down in the future, like you think it might happen if mortgage rates go down, prices go up.
Right?
So, like, no matter what happens, it's only bullish for home prices. Yeah.
I know what you mean. I think that's what keeps me awake, right? This is the stuff that I find worrying, and I find, I think, you know, you're right in saying it's going to be topics that the electorate is going to vote with and vote on.
All right. I didn't mean to get here, but I'm going to get here just because we go here just because we talked about it. One can make the argument that we are kind of bifurcating as an economy where the existing rich continue to do better. And everybody else just gets squeezed more and more here, right? When we talk, like, housing is a great example, right? We're at record levels of unaffordability in homes, right? I saw some stat that I think it said they did a survey of like close to 600 counties in the U.S. and in 99% of them, the median price of a house there was unaffordable to the average income earner. We're entering this world where basically, like, hey, you know, if you want the American dream, you know, you got to kind of already be born wealthy, or, you know, you're kind of out of luck. You know, the brass ring has moved far enough from you at this point that if you don't have some advantage, you're probably not going to get it. As you continue to look at, like, rising inflation and whatnot, I'm kind of picking up the vibe that you have sort of a similar concern about that, but am I being too dire here, or is that where the puck is headed at current status quo trajectories?
No, I think you're 100% right. And I think the biggest concern I've got in that is, if I look at this in a very macro picture, the Pew Research put out an article or some work out, they put out some fantastic work around the erosion of the middle class. And if you look at the last 40 years, we have really seen erosion of the middle class. I think it's dropped from like 62% of the U.S. economy down to now something like 55. I think it's 55% of the U.S. economy, or the U.S. population, is now considered middle class. And that gap of the erosion of the middle class, I can guarantee you, is not going upwards. It's going the other way. And you could argue that potentially, maybe because, as you already pointed out, it could be immigration policies, it could be a whole bunch of factors. But if the middle class is declining and the wealthier are getting wealthier, what has been the working horse of the U.S. economy since the Second World War has been the working class population. And if that's eroding, I don't know what that means in the longer term. So there needs to be an equilibrium here. There needs to be a rebalancing. And, you know, that's, for me, those are the big, big macro pictures. And onshoring, I think, could help on that. But that would mean that in the short term, shortish term, there will be an impact on pricing. But it certainly will bring jobs back to the U.S. and bring innovation back to the U.S., which I think is important. Because innovation is what fuels growth, and we need that innovation.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I actually am a fan of onshoring, knowing that it will be increasing cost structure, but hopefully it'll also be increasing wages for those people at the same time. all right, so one, I don't have time to get into this, but one resource that you should be aware of if you're not already are the charts that Chris Hamilton produces at Economica. And if that name doesn't, if it's not familiar to you, Oliver, I'm sure you'll notice the charts. You recognize the charts if you see them. But Chris tracks an awful lot of things. He's a chartist, but demographics is one that he spends a lot of time charting. And I had him on the program not that long ago, and he basically showed the projections for U.S. population, and they're pretty frightening from a national demographic standpoint. But the really key one there is that the cohort that drives economic growth, 25 to 54 year olds, on an absolute level, that cohort has actually it's already in population decline. So we just, adding the wealth gap and inequality element to it just makes it even worse. But for a guy in your job who's trying to predict where inflation's going, it's hard to actually get sustainable inflation in an era unless you're just killing the currency with bad monetary policy, which we're going to talk about in a second. It's hard to get that sort of sustained secular inflation if your percentage of workers, of able-bodied active workers, is in a secular decline. But anyways, a different story for a different day. Last big question I want to ask you, and I just tipped my cards there. So we've been talking about inflation in the course of this conversation as things becoming more expensive, right? Household budgets getting pinched. Let's talk about it in the context of just loss of purchasing power, right? So what is your outlook on the purchasing power of the dollar? And I guess any other fiat currencies, if you want to mention them as well. But I think the big issue for folks are not only having challenge saving, given the increase in cost of living rising faster than their wages, whatever they have left over, if they have anything left over, the purchasing power of that is getting less and less and less.
Yeah, I do think though that there is a sort of a bit of a bright light at the end of the tunnel on this topic, and that
Good, we need
is
some.
I think that is twofold. One is wage increases need to continue to going up, and that has to increase, right? I think the days of us offshoring work to bring deflationary market conditions to the US with the economic growth of China, they're over. They can still contribute a bit, I think, but this notion of bringing onshoring will help. Yes, I think there'll be a price pinch to the consumers that we spoke about earlier in the short term, but I think in the long term we're going to see wages increase, and that also comes with an increased innovation rates and education levels. So I'm of the conviction that in the long term we're going to have to adapt and evolve and innovate and take the lead, recapture the lead of that as we go forward in the more of a medium to longer term outlook.
Okay, and I can see that argument sort of resulting in more robust economic growth than maybe some pessimists are looking at right now. I'm just curious about your thoughts about the purchasing power of the currency going forward. So people might make more of the dollars, and maybe they're getting devalued, but you're making more, and it's equilibrating. I will say we have a lot of people watching this program who are worried about the future purchasing power of the dollar. So I want to get a sense for if you are as well. And if you are, then the follow-up question is what strategies, if any, do you think are worth considering to preserve purchasing power going forward?
Short answer is yes.
Okay.
I am worried about it. I think it's about a diversification that is required. But yeah, it's the question really is on the US dollar is what is the impact of the US on the global scale, right? And yes, the US currency as such is actually probably still, and I think in the short to medium term, it will still be the biggest currency in the market, in the world economy. And if you think about, you know, the number of $100 cash, $100 bills that are outside the US in circulation, it's a quite a considerable number. I don't have the exact stats on that, but I think it's
that's right. I've had Brent Johnson on here, and he's talked about the dollar milkshake theory. So this audience is familiar with the euro dollar market and all that stuff.
So look, I am concerned about it, but I do have faith that we need to diversify in the short term. But I think in the long term, I got faith that things will rebalance and we'll see a strength coming back. But I don't think it's going to go away. I just think the U.S. economy and the U.S. dollar is too strong in the world that we live in.
Okay. And just because I know folks are going to ask in the comments, are there any particular assets or strategies? Some would say own, you know, gold. Some would say own land. Some would say own Bitcoin. Some would say own stocks. You know, they tend mm-hmm. to do really well in periods of inflation. So any particular commentary on that? I mean, you're not a market analyst, a financial market analyst, more as you are a, you know, inflation analyst. So I don't want to push you out of your comfort zone, but if you have anything to say, I know folks would be interested.
Yeah, look, I've been very cagey in my response to the last question for that exact reason.
Okay, that's fine.
I know other people will know more than I do on this topic, and I'll probably defer to them. But for me personally, you know, I've been looking much more into the real world assets, the crypto world to diversify. Yes, it's more volatile, but I think it gives us an ability to invest in different things than what we have in the past, right? Everyone is invested in equities, everyone's invested in bonds. I think the bond market has been a good market to have in the past, going forward, less so potentially. You know, as I said, I'm not the expert in this, but I've been diversifying investments considerably, and I've been focused very much on the crypto world and real world assets, and trying to find ways to find new areas to fuel growth. And innovation is coming from that world at the moment, and this is where I think innovation is really needed to fuel growth, whether it's, you know, the EV battery markets for EV cars, whether it's solar energy, whatever else it is. You know, if we don't, the U.S. economy needs to find that edge about innovating again, that will fuel a new set of economy, and it's about investing in that. And I think right now the crypto world has been leading the way in that a bit, and so I've gone down that route. Whether it's the right way or not, I don't know. But the price points of Bitcoin right now are nearly an all-time high, and you know, I think it's been. But there's still more optimism to see how the markets in the crypto world evolve over the time period.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, look, two last questions for you. First one, very important. For folks that have really enjoyed this discussion, would like to follow you and your work in Trueflation, where should they go?
Yeah. So obviously, first of all, look at our website, trueflation.com. You can also look us up on Telegram, on Twitter. It's all at Trueflation. For me personally, reach out. I'm on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. Or you can just reach out to me at oliver@trueflation.com. But feel free to look at our website. There's a lot of materials there. And if there's any questions you have that you want to talk about, please do reach out.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you. And Oliver, when I edit this, I will put up the links to those resources on the screen. Folks, I'll also put links in the description below the video too, if you just want one click action access to those. All right, so in about 60 seconds, I'm gonna ask you the second question, Oliver, which is, hey, we've been talking about, you know, sort of money related topics, all conversation. I'd love to get a sense for one non-money related investment you would encourage folks to adopt in their lives. Real quick before I do, I just have a little bit of housekeeping to do so you can think of your answer in the interim there, Oliver. Folks, well, first off, if you've enjoyed this conversation with Oliver, would like to see him come back on in the future when he may see a trend change or anything going on in the inflation rate that he thinks is worthy of us knowing about, please vote your support for that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. I also just want to deliver another reminder that if you're watching this the day it goes out on Thursday, you have only until tomorrow night, Friday night at midnight, to lock in the lowest early bird price for the upcoming Thoughtful Money conference, online conference on Saturday, March 16th. As a reminder, if you can't watch it live, and a lot of people can't just because of life and weekends sometimes can be tough, don't worry, everybody who signs up for it is going to get replay videos of all the presentations as well as all the live Q&A sessions within 24 hours of the event's end. And again, just a reminder, if you are a premium subscriber to our Substack, you'll get an additional $50 off the conference by using the discount code that's been sent to all the premium subscribers. Also, just a note too, just locked in Danielle Park as another speaker for the conference. And folks, you may remember her, just had her on for the first time a couple of weeks ago. Folks really loved her commentary. And so I wanted to pull her into the conference. So now we've got both Danielles. We've got Danielle Park and Danielle DiMartino Booth. We have cornered the markets on Danielles for the conference. And then just a reminder, look, you know, as I say every week with the financial advisors on this channel, you know, your number one goal as an investor here is to be managing your wealth to basically meet or exceed the rate of inflation. That really should be your primary objective for wealth building and investing. That's the time-honored way to, you know, basically build and preserve your wealth over time, is just to make sure that you're putting together a strategy that doesn't get beaten by the inflation demon. If you've got a good professional financial advisor who understands that, gets all the issues that Oliver and I have talked about, as well as all the other folks that come on this channel every week, great, stick with them. But if you don't have a good financial quarterback who's doing that for you, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, then feel free to schedule a free consultation with one of the advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. To do that, just fill out the short form at thoughtfulmoney.com. These consultations are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these advisors. And these are the same advisors you see with me on this channel week after week after week. It's just a free public service they offer to help as many people as possible, position as prudently as possible, not to have their wealth eaten up by inflation. All right, Oliver, thanks for your patience there. We're at that final question here. What non-money related investment would you encourage folks to consider?
It's an interesting question. For me, it's all been around learning and constant learning and understanding different people's point of views and different cultures. And I think that gives people, or gives me certainly, a new perspective on things. There's always a different viewpoint, there's a different angle. And I think we as consumers and individuals are quick to jump to a conclusion. And I think it's important to have a perspective, an alternative perspective on life, on viewpoints and on cultures and how that changes everything. And so I just encourage everyone to be on the mindset of willingness of continuing to learn.
It's a great answer. I would echo that, not just on the continuing to learn, but the continuing to seek out alternative points of view, because it's so easy in today's digital media world to create our own echo chambers of sources that we just like hearing because they agree with our inherent biases. Getting exposure to other ways of thinking, other points of view, other cultures, like you said, other lenses through which to see the world, super helpful in making sure that we are making truly informed decisions, and not just, again, like, you know, reaffirming our own biases. And I say that as a guy with my own media channel here. I highly encourage people to watch and consume other media from other different sources, particularly those that have a different point of view. And I try to chart as impartial a course as I can, but highly recommend that people, you know, again, I try to pick a pretty independent, moderate course. I would encourage people to, you know, go find something on the more conservative side and go find something more on the progressive side and see if there's, you know, other bits out there that make you enrich your ability to see the larger picture. So anyways, Andrew, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you saying that as a man who is up past midnight over in Asia right now, having stayed up to do this. So you're walking your talk.
Yeah, thanks a lot. No, I love it. I think it's wielding, and it's impactful on oneself as well as on others, just to learn something new and look at something through, as you said, through a different lens. But it's an experience. I live for those experiences, and so the more and more I can be challenged, I love it. So. That's also what gets me into this economic data aspect with inflation measurement, because everyone's got a point of view, right?
And it's great to hear those. No matter where they live. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, look,
So,
Andrew, this has been
all right.
wonderful. Thank you so much. Like I said, love to have you back on the program whenever your models there are telling you there's something important that we all need to know. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks a lot.